The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to That's a Laugh. I'm Jennifer Green with the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining me for the next half hour of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. We'll start off today's episode with a few quotes found on purewow.com. The heart wants what the heart wants. Cookies. It's always cookies. My favorite flavor of cake is more. Eating a croissant. Expectation, fancy and French. Reality, crumb apocalypse. Noticing a theme here yet? Then you are correct. Today's episode is all about food. Do you like food? Do you love food? Could you not live without food? Okay, that last one was a trick question. But our authors would really rather not live without food. Today we'll hear stories about the love of food from our younger years, food we can share with our children, and the fun we can have with food and friends. First, think about your favorite kind of food. When you go to a restaurant or other outing, what kind of meal do you prefer? David Sedaris tells us about his food preferences in his book, Me Talk Pretty One Day, published in 2000. The chapter, Today's Special. It is his birthday, and Hugh and I are seated in a New York restaurant awaiting the arrival of our 15-word entrees. He looks very nice, dressed in the suit and sweater that have always belonged to him. As for me, I own only my shoes, pants, shirt, and tie. My jacket belongs to the restaurant and was offered as a loan by the maitre d', who apparently thought I would feel more comfortable dressed to lead a high school marching band. I'm wearing the thick gold braids decorating my sleeves when the waiter presents us with what he calls a little something to amuse the palate. Roughly the size and color of a Band-Aid, the amusement floats on a shallow, muddy puddle of sauce and is topped with a sprig of greenery. "And this would be what exactly?" Hugh asks. "This," the waiter announces, "is our raw Atlantic swordfish served in a dark chocolate gravy and garnished with fresh mint." "Not again," I say. "Can't you guys come up with something a little less conventional?" "Love your jacket," the waiter whispers. As a rule, I'm no great fan of eating out in New York restaurants. It's hard to love a place that's outlawed smoking, but finds it perfectly acceptable to serve raw fish in a bath of chocolate. There are no normal restaurants left, at least in our neighborhood. The diners have all been taken over by precious little bistros boasting a menu of indigenous American cuisine. They call these meals traditional, yet they're rarely the American dishes I remember. The patty melt has been pushed aside in favor of the herb-encrusted medallions of baby artichoke hearts, which never leave me thinking, "Oh, right, those. I wonder if they're as good as the ones my mom used to make." Part of the problem is that we live in the wrong part of town. Soho is not a macaroni salad kind of place. This is where the world's brightest young talents come to braise caramelized racks of corn-fed songbirds, or offer up their famous knuckle of flash-seared crappie served with a collar of chided ginger and cornered by a tribe of kiln-roasted Chilean toadstools, teased with a warm spray of clarified musk oil. Even when they promise something simple, they've got to tart it up. The meatloaf has been poached in seawater, or there are figs in the tuna salad. If cooking is an art, I think we're in our dada phase. I've never thought of myself as a particularly finicky eater, but it's hard to be a good sport when each dish seems to include no fewer than a dozen ingredients, one of which I'm bound to dislike. I'd order the skirt steak with a medley of suffocated peaches, but I'm put off by the aspirin sauce. The sea scallops look good, until I'm told they're served in a broth of malt liquor and mummified lychee nuts. What I really want is a cigarette, and I'm always searching the menu in the hope that some courageous young chef has finally recognized tobacco as a vegetable. Bake it, steam it, grill it, or stuff it into little neck clams. I just need something familiar that I can hold on to. When the waiter brings our entrees, I have no idea which plate might be mine. In yesterday's restaurants, it was possible to both visualize and to recognize your meal. There were always subtle differences, but for the most part, the lamb chop tended to maintain its basic shape. That is to say that it looked chop-like. It had a handle made of bone and a teardrop of meat hugged by a thin rind of fat. Apparently, though, that was too predictable. Order the modern lamb chop, and it's likely to look no different than your companion's order of shackled pompano. The current food is always arranged into a senseless vertical tower. No longer content to recline, it now reaches for the sky, much like the high-rise buildings lining our city streets. It's as if the plates were valuable parcels of land, and the chef had purchased one small lot and unlimited air rights. Hugh's saffron linguine resembles a miniature turban topped with architectural spires of shrimp. It stands there in the center, while the rest of the vast empty plate looks though it's been leased out as a possible parking lot. I had ordered the steak, which, bowing to the same minimalist fashion, is served without the bone, the thin slices of beef stacked to resemble a funeral pyre. The potatoes I've been expecting have apparently either been clarified to an essence or were used to stoke the grill. Maybe, Hugh says, they're inside your tower of meat. This is what we have been reduced to. Hugh blows the yucca pollen off his blackened shrimp while I push back the sleeves of my borrowed sports coat and search the tower, the meat tower, for my promised potatoes. There they are, right there. Hugh uses his fork to point out what could easily be mistaken for five cavity-riddled molars. The dark spots must be my vegetable. Because I am both a glutton and a masochist, my standard complaint, "That was so bad," is always followed by, "And there was so little of it." Our plates are cleared, and we are presented with dessert menus. I learn that spiced ham is no longer considered just a luncheon meat, and that even back issues of Smithsonian can be turned into sorbets. "I just couldn't," I say to the waiter when he recommends the white chocolate and wild loganberry couscous. If we're counting calories, I could have the chef serve it without the creme fraiche. "No," I say, "really, I just couldn't." We ask for the check, explaining that we have a movie to catch. It's only a 10-minute walk to the theater, but I'm antsy because I'd like to get something to eat before the show. They'll have lots of food at the concession stand, but I don't believe in mixing meat with my movies. Luckily, there's a hot dog cart not too far out of our way. Friends always say, "How can you eat those? I read in the paper that they're made from hog's lips." And hearts and eyelids. That, to my mind, is only three ingredients and constitutes a refreshing change of pace. I order mine with nothing but mustard and am thrilled to watch the vendor present my hot dog in a horizontal position, so simple and timeless that I can recognize it immediately as food. Getting hungry yet? Yeah, me too. Our next author is a food expert. Sort of. Jim Gaffigan loves food, so much that he wrote two books that focus on his love of food and family and food. First, we'll hear why he's qualified to write so much about food in his book, Food, A Love Story, published in 2014. The chapter, Why Food? As many of you know, I am a comedian who, with the immeasurable assistance of my wife Jeannie, wrote a book called Dad is Fat, which chronicled my life as the father of five young children in a two-bedroom apartment in New York City. The book enjoyed some success and changed how people raised their children. Well, okay, fine. The book enjoyed some success. Anyway, I was approached about the possibility of writing another book. I thought long and hard. I knew if I did a second book, I wanted it to be as good or even better than Dad is Fat. I know, impossible, right? I didn't want only to be known as the really good-looking guy who wrote one terrific book. So, like a good author, I spent some time reflecting while I rewatched all 6 seasons of Lost on Netflix. I then thought about who I am and what I know. Then I had a breakthrough. In the comedy world, what was I known for? What was my comedy associated with? Obviously, I'm known for and associated with, you guessed it, being good-looking. But what else did my comedy say about me? Boom! I was a good-looking comedian who talked about food. This, of course, led to a brilliant idea. What if I wrote a book that was edible? I pitched it to my publishers, who were so trapped in the old publishing model that they got caught up in how bookstores don't have refrigerators, how to deal with digital delivery, and a bunch of other book nerd stuff. Whatever. It was at that point that I decided to do the next logical thing. I ate a ham sandwich. Then I decided to write a book about food. And there you have it. What? You're still not convinced that Jim Gaffigan knows his stuff when it comes to food? Okay, let's hear a little more from Food, A Love Story, the chapter, An E.T., Not a Foodie. Now that I've convinced you to read this book, I should clarify something. I have strong opinions about food, but I am not a food expert or a foodie. I couldn't name more than 3 celebrity chefs, and I've never posted on Yelp. I have 5 young children and work nightly as a stand-up comedian, so I rarely go out to dinner. What I have is a general and very personal knowledge of food. I know which food I enjoy. I know which food I hate. I know how food makes me feel. I realize that because of my food obsession, the fact that I am writing a book about food could mistakenly give some people the impression that I think of myself as a foodie, but I don't. I think of myself as an eatie. I don't have anything against foodies. I appreciate their love of food, and I envy their knowledge and culinary escapades, but I'm generally satisfied with what I've been eating. Foodies seem to be on a never-ending search for new restaurants and interesting dishes. I don't have an insatiable desire to discover what makes something taste good or to find exotic combinations. I guess I'm not that bored. This is not to say that I don't appreciate today's chefs trying to expand the horizons of the culinary arts. I just don't need a Japanese taco or cranberry sauce on my steak. There is plenty of regular food I still want to enjoy. I wish it were more complicated than that, but it's not. I am also way too lazy to be a foodie. Foodies will travel for miles in search of the perfect hamburger. There is this place in Greenpoint that's only an hour by train and a 40-minute walk from the subway that has the best burger in town. It can't be better than the burger I can get across the street. Mostly, I just want the closest best burger in town. The reason I know about so many great places to eat all over the country is not because I traveled to those cities and towns to seek out those restaurants. It's because I was in those cities and towns to perform stand-up comedy. All I have to do is ask a food-loving follower on Twitter where to eat in that particular city, and bam! Shortly thereafter, I'm cramming my face full of the best food in town. Yes, I'm lazy, but I'm resourceful. I travel a lot, and I like to eat. Besides asking my followers on Twitter or approaching strangers in cities I visit about where I should eat, I do no research. Most cities have at least one food place that locals recommend with pride. Well, while you are here, you have to eat at this place. Unfortunately, this is not the case everywhere. Once I was in Rapid City, South Dakota, and asked a cab driver for a local restaurant that was unique to Rapid City. He replied in a very matter-of-fact manner, "There's nothing. You should go to Outback Steakhouse." "Nothing?" I didn't believe him, so I pressed on. "Well, where did you go before chain places like Outback Steakhouse were here?" "Nowhere," he replied. "Is it possible the fine people of Rapid City did not eat outside their homes prior to the arrival of chain restaurants?" "Of course not." "Well, hopefully not. I don't know. I didn't do the research." I asked another 2 people in Rapid City, and nobody had suggestions. Therefore, in this book, there is no reference to some local Rapid City food specialty. This isn't meant as a slam on Rapid City. This is a commentary on my research method, or lack of a research method. If your favorite local food place isn't referenced in this fine book, it's because I didn't go to your town, or the local stranger I asked didn't suggest it, or someone didn't mention it on Twitter. It is also possible that I'm too dumb and lazy to remember the place. After all, I'm an eatie, not a foodie. So Jim Gaffigan has traveled far and wide and enjoyed everything from good food to great food. But what about food that isn't so great? Yes, he's enjoyed that too. Well, he was forced into enjoying that too. No, really. We all know of a place that preys on the tired and hungry, especially when kids are in the car. Jim Gaffigan tells us all about it in his other book, Dad is Fat, published in 2013. The chapter, You Win, McDonald's. It's just too easy. I'm sorry. I know McDonald's is horrible for you, and taking my children to McDonald's is irresponsible. I even understand the evil behind the Happy Meal. A free toy with a meal? It's evil genius. Just like a divorced parent, McDonald's knows if you want a child to come back, you have to bribe them. I know McDonald's is essentially buying another generation of consumers. Even crack dealers find McDonald's unscrupulous. But McDonald's is too easy. They could provide small packs of cigarettes in every Happy Meal, and I would still go to McDonald's on long car rides with my children. Me. Okay, honey, you can have the apple dippers with the jug of caramel dipping sauce, but not the cigarettes. 5-year-old. Just one. Me. All right, just one. But don't smoke when you're pregnant. Anyone who has had to travel over an hour with a little kid in a car has been to McDonald's. All experienced parents eventually reach the same conclusion. Why should I stop at McDonald's and get my kid crappy chicken nuggets when I could wait until we get to the hotel and get my kids crappy chicken strips for $20? McDonald's wins. You don't have to get out of your car. You are taking your kids out to dinner, but you don't have to take them out to dinner. You don't have to clean any dishes. The box that the Happy Meal comes in transforms magically into a mini garbage can. You even already know how disappointed you are going to feel about going there. You win, McDonald's. It's not just traveling. McDonald's is an amazing bargaining chip with your children. If you keep behaving like that, I'm not taking you to McDonald's. I mentioned earlier that my father would force me and my siblings to do yard work every Saturday for hours when I was growing up. What I failed to mention is that my father would reward us by taking us to McDonald's at the end of the day. It seemed like a great deal when I was 8. Of course, the irony is that my dad had to feed us anyway. Cough! How about you do 8 hours of yard work and in exchange, I'll feed you dinner? Deal. Of course, we would have been fed dinner, but this was McDonald's. Really, the best and worst part about taking your kids to McDonald's is that you find yourself at McDonald's. The strongest willpower melts away. You have an excuse, a justification, for eating McDonald's. Well, I'm here anyway. Guess I have to get the quarter pounder with cheese. I've even mastered justifying a stop at McDonald's drive-thru when all of my kids are asleep. Hey, we finally found a McDonald's! Oh, the kids are asleep. Well, I'm here anyway. Guess I have to get the quarter pounder with cheese. You win, McDonald's. Wow, sounds like going out for a meal with loved ones is hard work, especially when the cost of food is constantly on the rise. Not to worry. R. Scott Murphy gives us great advice on how to keep eating out fun with friends and, of course, food. From his book, Fun Stories Greatest Hits, published in 2019, the chapter, Mint Condition. Do you like to barbecue? It's not just about the food. It's a way of life in Texas. Where I live, here in Austin, we have many acclaimed barbecue establishments, including the now world-famous Franklin Barbecue, which was voted best barbecue joint in America by Bon Appetit. Down the road from Austin, there are four tremendous barbecue restaurants in Lockhart, Texas. I once took my parents on a barbecue crawl where we hit all four Lockhart places in a single afternoon. I had to loosen my belt for that one. Keep traveling away from Lockhart, and it's almost impossible to miss City Market in Luling, Texas. I'm getting hungry just typing this story. Bottom line, always get some good brisket if you visit the Central Texas area. Because of the fame of the restaurant, however, the line at Franklin Barbecue can last several hours. I just don't have the time or patience to do that more than once or twice a year. No worries. There are at least a dozen other barbecue places in Austin that are fantastic. We maintain a chart at work, read the annual Texas Monthly Barbecue Rankings, and even have the barbecue app on our phones. This story, however, is not about all of that great barbecue. It's about the game within the barbecue game. It's about the mince. At many of the barbecue restaurants in Texas, there is a bowl of mince, usually Starlight mince. It's always fun to pick up a few of them to conclude the experience. It's not something you usually plan ahead of time. Until now. Lately, barbecue has become quite expensive. Some places have increased the prices of their barbecue lunch plates from $7 or $8 to as high as $13 and $15. In fact, briskets have hit a $25 a pound at the highest priced places. Suffice to say that barbecue lunches are now more of a special occasion, not an every week thing. You know the drill. Make a wrong call and you could land in trouble at home for spending way too much on your work lunch. In addition to my wife being a CPA, I work with a bunch of accountants. It's a good thing. What this means for me is that I am a part of a group of people who are always looking for the best deals or the best examples of added value. That said, earlier in the year, I went to lunch with a couple of work friends who are accountants. We frowned when we noticed that the prices at the barbecue place we once prized for being inexpensive had gone up yet again. It was too late in our lunch hour to leave, so we tried to configure our orders so as to feel like we received some sort of added value. I jokingly said that we were going to have to grab extra mince at the end of the meal to help balance the rising prices. To that end, I later went by the mint bowl several times, grabbing a handful during each visit. When we returned to work, I pulled them out of my pocket and counted them. I proudly proclaimed that I owned 21 mints. I challenged my co-workers to top that total. We all laughed about it, and a couple of guys even said they had accepted my challenge. Since the prices had gone up on all of the lunch specials at this particular barbecue joint, it was at least a couple of months before we went there to eat again. It was a birthday lunch for a co-worker. I kind of forgot that I had previously set a challenge to beat my record of 21 mints. There was not even talk of mints in the line as we placed our orders. It was a good lunch, with lively conversation, and my friend Mark was the first to finish. He had cleaned his plate thoroughly. Still, once he finished, he went to the front of the restaurant and asked for a medium-sized to-go box. We all found this curious. From there, He walked straight to the mint bowl and began tossing mints into the box. I have never before and never since seen anyone go get a to-go box for their mints. It was a bold move, one that was sure to lead to a new mint record. I couldn't help but laugh as he finished filling the box, closed the lid, and marched back to the table with a smirk on his face. Once we were back at the office, the counting began. Yes, it was easily a new record of 42 mints. Holy cow! Mark had elevated the mint game to an impressive new level. We have not been back to this restaurant since 42 Day, but we have so much respect for the new record that we are not even going to try to break it. That's a special level of added value that makes all of us smile. Our Scott Murphy has another food game he likes to play. Also from Fun Story's Greatest Hits, The Sample Life. Some years ago, society princesses Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie appeared in a reality show called The Simple Life. This is not about that. This is about the sample game. I like to call the whole experience The Sample Life. Truth be told, I'll sample almost any type of food that you can jam onto a toothpick at Sam's or Costco, even things I would never eat under normal circumstances. Broccoli cheese hot dog? Is it on a toothpick? Yes? Count me in. Put barbecue sauce on anything, then toothpick it. Bingo, I'm in. If I really like something, I'll circle back 10 minutes later for a second toothpick. The sample people know I'm doing it, but they never raise a fuss about it. That's just how the sample life works. In summary, offer it for free. Put a few people in line ahead of me waiting for it, and my mouth will start salivating like Pavlov's dog. Well, my dear listeners, we have just enough time for these words to the wise from purewow.com. There is no we in ice cream. I'm Jennifer Green with the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Join me again next month for That's a Laugh. I'll be back on the fourth Tuesday of every month, and I hope you'll listen again next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Just click on the podcasts link under the listen bar at the top of the homepage. Are you enjoying the show? Do you have any amusing quotes or anecdotes you'd like to share? We'd love to hear from you. Let us know. Please call us with questions, requests, or other comments about this or any of your NCRS programs at 919-832-5138. That number for the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service, one more time, is 919-832-5138.